Pushkin.
This is probably the first episode I'm actually nervous about. I'm not nervous in a shaky sense. I'm nervous about like striking the right balance and how, you know, we talk about Obama in this book. And so
I'm here for you. I'm gonna be a gentle leader. I'm gonna protect you. We're gonna get through this together. Okay. I won't let you get hurt.
All right. Yeah. Well, that remains to be seen.
I'm Khalil Gibran Muhammad.
And I'm Ben Austin. We're two best friends.
One black.
One white.
I'm a historian.
And I'm a journalist.
And this is Some of My Best Friends Are.
In this show, we wrestle with the challenges
and the absurdities
of a deeply divided and unequal country.
And today's show, we're going to talk about two really incredible people that we have already been talking about for a long time.
That's right, Barack and Michelle Obama. You know, they were actually here in Chicago just the other day, down the block from where I'm sitting right now, breaking ground on the Obama Presidential Library.
And we have been eager to dig into their biographies.
Memoirs, their autobiographies. Yeah, we're going to talk about Michelle and Barack Obama's books.
Yeah, I mean, like, and the titles, like, Becoming what? That's fascinating. And then A Promised Land. Yes, yes.
So we're going to look at these books to look at how they talk about race.
And racism, because we've been trying to figure them out for quite a while. Let's do this.
Book club. Chapter one.
Chapter one, yeah. All right, so look, before we really get into this episode, I have to make it crystal clear. Look, Barack Obama is adored and loved by many. I love him in so many ways, but he's a complicated figure. And so I just, you know, needed to be clear that people like my wife, Stephanie, are like, look, this is my first black president, period. End of story.
These are Obama's fireworks, whether they are or not, that's what they are for us.
That was actually from when we were on Martha's Vineyard this summer. And we got out of our car because there were fireworks over the water, and I had to press record on my phone.
That's right.
People thought that the fireworks might be for Barack Obama's birthday.
This is way too many fireworks for it to be random. I'm just saying, this is Obama fireworks. And I don't care if he's too conservative or not, this is the black president. You just celebrate yourself some Obama. That's right, baby.
I love my wife. She doesn't mince her words. But anyways, during all the release and news coverage about A Promised Land coming out, Obama's new memoir, I was so excited to hear Obama talk about the book in general, right? He was giving interviews and I happened to be in the shower and it was late afternoon. I'm, you know, after a workout or something. And it's all things considered, I'm super excited. And I'm like, oh my God, I got to call Ben because I got to let him know that Obama's on talking about his book. And for me in particular, what I was fascinated, at least anticipating, was he hadn't talked almost at all in the wake of the 4 years of Trump. Very little he had to say.
I mean, he was writing a 700-page book.
Well, that's true. But I'm not the only one who felt like that, you know, that we could have used more from him to
talk about what the hell
was going on in the country. Yeah. Okay, so that was one reason that I was fascinated to hear this interview. And then the second reason is because it was, although it was November, he hadn't said very much about the madness of the George Floyd summer and the protests and all of that.
Yeah, we are. I mean, just thinking about that crazy moment, it's after the election. Biden has won. Trump hasn't conceded. We're in the middle of the pandemic. We're coming after the summer of George Floyd.
Yeah.
It's fucking madness.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And then we get smooth jazz Barry.
Right. So he's giving an interview to Michelle Martin and they immediately get to the race issue.
Well, as I write, particularly when you start looking at police issues. And that's why I think what happened this summer with George Floyd was so important, where you saw at least some shift in the general population in recognizing that there's real racial bias in how our criminal laws are applied and how policing operates in this country. What I realized was that nothing touches a nerve more in terms of the relationship between the races in this country than issue of policing.
We all know that Obama's brilliant and very thoughtful in his speech and with thinking a lot of complicated ideas, and that he's not the fastest talker, right? But oh my God, man. I mean, do you remember how frustrated I was? I was like,
Yeah.
Every word that came out of his mouth about how he was understanding what was happening around racism in the country was like dripping one syllable at a time.
Well, the dripping metaphor is good because you're in the shower. But you had developed a theory after this that he speaks more slowly when he's talking about race than about other issues.
Yeah. And it probably could be empirically proven. I haven't done it yet, even though I'm the one who's the so-called
scholar.
But
why do you think that is? So you came up with this theory at that moment. We call it the shower theory.
Yeah, I'm just listening to an interview. But now that I've read the book, I mean, the theory is now for real. Like, he doesn't want to own... Notice I'm modeling Obama thoughtfulness.
No, you are speaking slow as fuck.
He doesn't want to own the burden of making white people feel like they're all racists. He actually has a thing about black people who think white people are in general racist. And he rejects this view over and over again in the book.
I resisted the notion held by some of the black folks I knew that white people were irredeemably racist. The conviction that racism wasn't inevitable may also explain my willingness to defend the American idea, what the country was and what it could become.
He calls it out.
But do you think so that means he's weighing his words even more carefully?
Yes, I think he is weighing his words because he doesn't want to give the impression that he's one of those kind of black people.
Maybe he's speaking really slowly, just hoping that people won't listen.
Well, I think what he's doing, like, here's my takeaway on this point. I think he's just trying not to give that impression to white people. He wants white people to like him, or at least to listen to him in such a way that they won't confuse him with those crazy, radical, racist black people.
Yeah, so we didn't do an empirical study of how he speaks and his pace, but we did go back and read these two books, and we read them really carefully, and we're going to talk about them in depth.
Yep, let's do it. I mean, listen, there is so much in this book to talk about. And one of the things that I think is really important to start with is his conception of the American story, the nation itself, like how he understands the promise of the nation, hence the title of the book. And he gets at it right away. I mean, the preface in many ways may be the most revealing of how Obama talks about race and democracy. I mean,
this is like one of those book reports where it sounds like you only read the preface.
I know.
You're like the most important part is in the first four pages.
But I can assure you, Barack, if you're listening, I read the entire book.
Okay.
Now, that being said, you know, this notion, we talk a lot, you and me, about American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
And usually for me, it's like the myth of American exceptionalism.
Yeah. Right? So American exceptionalism, the idea that this country is really the greatest country in the world, that we are the most perfect nation. And we're striving towards a perfect nation, but we're already like leaps and bounds ahead of others. From our founding and a sense of equality and democracy to now, that we are the leading democracy in the world.
Right. That there's something about this notion of the American dream, about everyone can have their cake and eat it too if they just work hard enough.
For sure.
Usually for us falls short of reality, and we spend a lot of time trying to square that myth with reality.
Yep.
So Obama gets right at it. I mean, in the preface, he basically says, you know, I recognize that there are those who believe that it's time to discard the myth. And then he even says that the critiques of him as someone who is committed to American exceptionalism means that he has been, quote unquote, understood to be too tempered in speaking the truth, too cautious in either word or deed. I mean, this guy understands himself, right, where he fits in the world, and the ideas that are at stake with the choices that he has made and the choices he's likely to make in his post-presidency. And so at the end of the day, he says, like, for him, he's not ready to give up. He cites Lincoln. He says, like, Lincoln called out the better angels of our nation. He says, I think we stand a better chance believing in the promise of America. And he says, of course, the jury is still out, but I think this book is for young people. This is an invitation for them to remake the world, to work hard, to be determined, and to make America finally achieve what it's always believed is possible.
So I'm really interested in that idea that you take from the premise that we have this, the myth and reality, but he's still incredibly hopeful and is going to strive towards good.
Yeah.
And then how he applies that to some of these specific moments, and talks about them, some of these kind of racial trigger moments in his presidency.
So he basically talks about two Americas. There is essentially the America of the Confederacy, the America of slave owners, of people committed to segregation and Jim Crow, an America where there are real racist bigots and people who don't believe in democracy. And then there's this other America, the America that he believes in, the America that elected him twice, the America that is the one that made promises that will be the beacon of light to guide us to the future. Because one of the things that becomes clear very quickly is that what Obama calls race, or what he describes as our racial past, and what we might call as racism, is for him a thing of the past. He has a clear-eyed understanding of the realness of racism that is situated in our past, but he does not call it the same thing in our present.
Here's one thing I never believed, right? Was the fever of racism being broken by my election. But I never subscribed to the, we live in a post-racial era. But I think that what did happen during my presidency was, yes, a backlash among some people who felt that somehow I symbolized the possibility that they or their group were losing status just by virtue of the fact that I didn't look like all the other presidents previously.
It is almost as if in the present, what we might recognize as racism are grievances, resentments, slights, and things that are in people's head.
So Khalil, I spoke to one of the smartest people I know about books, Jennifer Salai. She's brilliant. She has reviewed pretty much every single political memoir over the last 4 years.
I think public figures in general, when they read a memoir, it is often about, you know, either trying to explain themselves, trying to excuse themselves, and trying to shape the contours of how they're remembered.
She actually reviewed both of these books, Becoming and A Promised Land, in the Times. So I asked her, basically, like, how do these books function? Meaning, if we're going to look into these books, you know, how are we supposed to judge them? And this is one of the things that Jen told me.
I do think that his way of thinking, even if it turns out sometimes to be politically frustrating and is not necessarily what you want from a politician, especially when the stakes are really high, but I think as a reader, I do appreciate reading along in someone's consciousness who is, you know, very self-aware and also aware of the situation at hand. I think that that can actually have, you know, maybe real world hindrances when it comes to dealing with some of these things.
Oh, man, that line when she says that he's, you know, thoughtful, very self-aware and informed. That's it. Like, she's got it exactly right, just in terms of my, you know, like one of my major impressions, aside from watching him very thoughtfully and deliberatively talk about complicated things over the course of his presidency, reading his memoir, I was struck by the fact that all the times that I would have pulled him by his lapel and said, Barack, this is what you need to do. And then given him a history lesson or some kind of policy context or something like, the New Deal didn't work for Black people. The universal programs won't get us there to racial justice. Like any of those moments I felt over the course of his administration, I learned by reading this book that he'd taken all that into account.
Yeah.
Like I came away from the book thinking to myself, I could not have passed on any nugget of information or historical context or wisdom that he didn't already know. And in that, she's right. He's brilliant. He's incredibly well-informed.
Let's turn to Michelle Obama's Becoming.
Let's do it.
Becoming came out at the same time as my book, High Risers. And I would go to the bookstore, you know, fucking excited, like, there's my book on the stand. And I would see people come in and buy Becoming. This is on the south side of Chicago. Like they were shopping for toilet paper during the pandemic. They would like grab six or seven and, you know, and just like walk to the register. And I was like, oh, shit. That's how you sell a lot of books.
They were making an investment, man. Those books, they were thinking those books are going to be worth a lot of money on eBay one day.
It was before Christmas of 2018, and people were just giving them away.
Yeah.
You know, that was in everyone's stocking or under their menorah or
on the Kwanzaa table.
And the Kwanzaa.
So you had, in many ways, the better of the two tasks, because I read a whole bunch of foreign policy. I mean, I know more about what was going on in the world during Obama years than most people in the world who were living in those places. But I digress.
So the first time Michelle Obama is really thrust into the national stage is this moment in 2008 when she's on the campaign trail for her husband.
Let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country. And not just because Barack has done well, but because I think people are hungry for change.
And what she means is that there's even a Black candidate for president. But it becomes this sort of highly politicized moment. And to think of her,
it becomes her angry Black woman moment.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. She suddenly gets stamped as an angry Black woman. You know, there's you know, this idea that she is a radical who, like, the most radical thing she's ever done is decide not to be a lawyer.
But it's also a radicalism that is interpreted through the right wing media as someone who hates America.
Yes.
Because if this is the first time and she's a grown up adult, then then she must have been hating on the country all this time.
So for us to talk about how she talks about race, this is a good starting point, because it is this sort of touchstone moment for her.
Yeah, and I can't wait. I know what Obama says about it. He was like, we shouldn't have even put her up there without practice, which is interesting. But I can't wait to hear what she says about it.
I'm going to actually tell you about how the book is written to sort of explain. Becoming is written in three parts.
Okay.
And the first part is called Becoming Me. The second part is called Becoming Us. And the third part is called Becoming More. The book is kind of self-empowerment, sort of has this kind of self-help, self-actualization. She keeps on talking about finding her voice. Mm-hmm. And she talks a lot about how women support women. Mm-hmm. And the part that you just mentioned, where she says this in Madison, Wisconsin, occurs late in the second part of Becoming Us, which is about her and Barack becoming a couple and then him running for president. The third part is when they're in the White House. But to really answer that question, I have to go back to the first part, which is about her becoming me.
Oh, so you're teasing us. You're setting this up, right?
I just got to explain the context. You can't understand it. I'm giving the book its due.
Okay.
Because I got to say, like, that first part, I love that first part. Mm. The first part of the book is, which is about her and her upbringing, is beautiful. It's beautifully written. It's powerfully written. It's so specific and rich in detail.
Wow. And I hope you read something from it.
And Michelle's book is so specifically about being Black working class on the South Side of Chicago and of a certain moment in time, which mm-hmm. we know, which is after civil rights. It's so grounded in that moment and in such detail. Now, I don't live that experience, but for me, part of the pleasure of the book is that it's so familiar in locale. You know, she is growing up a couple blocks from me. She gets on the 6 Jeffrey bus, which is my bus.
Yep, I know that bus. That's my bus too.
She goes to Whitney Young, where my niece goes. You know, her and her friends go to Water Tower to ride up and down the escalator, which is what we did.
That's right. Marshall Fields was where I got all my back to school clothes. Because yes, nice. I was Black and bougie in a way. Black and bougie. Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, she talks about racial turnover in the neighborhood, which is, you know, it's my experience of suddenly you see all these churches that 10, 15, 20 years before were synagogues. It's just incredibly familiar. But I think the book, it would even other people reading it would feel this sense of familiarity because that's just good writing. You see mm-hmm. it. And it's also about striving. It's also about being, the very first line of the book is, I spent much of my childhood listening to the sounds of striving. And she's talking specifically about her aunt. They live in a split level home and her aunt is teaching piano below her. But, you know, it's as a metaphor, she extends it of being somebody who wants to achieve, who thinks about this and is kind of on a path almost thoughtlessly. She talks about herself being a box checker. She's such a rule follower. You know, yeah. Michelle gives Obama this grounded experience, you know, a sense of place. So back to the idea of when she says, you know, this is the first time I've been proud of my country, because it's really in the details and in mm-hmm. the details of her experience. She doesn't have to say it exactly. It's actually been shown. She has this sketch of her grandfather, and I'm going to read you a little bit of it.
Okay. I'm really glad you're going to read a little bit of it.
If this were an American dream story, Dandy, which is what she calls her grandfather, who arrived in Chicago in the early 1930s, would have found a good job and a pathway to college. But the reality was far different. Jobs were hard to come by, limited at least somewhat by the fact that managers at some of the big factories in Chicago regularly hired Europeans over African-American workers. Dandy took what work he could find, setting pins in the bowling alley and freelancing as a handyman. Gradually, he downgraded his hopes, letting go of the idea of college, thinking he'd train to become an electrician instead. But this, too, was quickly thwarted. And so then she talks about not experiencing the American dream.
Yeah,
she has this really amazing depiction of her father. And you'd ask, what are her parents do? Her father works in the water department for the city of Chicago. And he also has stunted dreams. He wanted to be an artist. He was an athlete, but then he gets MS. He gets multiple sclerosis. And he is just somebody who works so hard and works kind of like silently and tirelessly. And she tells this amazing story of his car and how much he loves his car. And his car is sort of like a symbol of success and rising up, but also giving him mobility because of his disease. And he has this car. It's a bronze-colored two-door Buick Electra 225.
Oh, yeah.
Which he calls a deuce and a quarter.
I was going to say it, man. Yeah. I wanted to call it out just before you did. Of course it's a deuce and a quarter.
A deuce and a quarter. So then she tells this story of, you know, someone in the neighborhood, a Black family, one of their neighbors, moves to the suburbs. And it's like, what? They move to the suburbs. And so they live in the city on the South Side of Chicago. And they get in the car one day, Michelle, her brother Craig, her parents, and they drive out there in the deuce and a quarter to see this family. And they're like, you know, suburbs are kind of weird. There's all these white people looking at them. They have a house. Like, you know, she doesn't think it's that appealing. At the end of the day, they leave to go home. And they get to their car, and there's a giant scratch in it. Wow. Someone has run a rock or something across the driver's side.
Wow.
And her dad
for a Black man, his castle is his car. Like in a way that, like, having, you know, the American dream embodied in a mortgage and a great home. If you couldn't have that, the next thing you could have is an amazing ride, like a deuce and a quarter. Now some asshole has scratched it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's about race. I mean, they're in a white
neighborhood. It's about racism. Let's be clear. That's
it's about racism.
Yeah.
And what her father says is, well, I'll be damned. Mm. And then they don't talk about it again.
Yeah.
So that's how she talks about that moment. That's how she explains it.
Yeah. So when you say the devil's in the details, like the narrative arc of that kind of origin story for Michelle, when she sees a racist act that Obama might call a racial slight, because he doesn't really talk about such things in the kind of forceful way. So she bears direct witness, like, to the vulnerability and innocence of her own family, and yet they could be subject to this degrading assault on just their basic dignity, then helps to explain why she is now on this national stage, potentially be about to become the first lady, and is like, holy smokes, like, I'm seeing a part of America that I'd never really known personally before until now.
Yeah, this ties to something that Jen Salai said to me when I interviewed her.
I did get a sense of political pessimism in her book. You know, not quite in his book, but in her book, where, you know, the implication is that there's only so much that politics can do to change something as deeply entrenched in American institutions as racism.
You know, people love Michelle Obama for her realness. Mm-hmm. She's relatable in this way that her husband isn't, who's, you know, is professorial and cerebral and, like, sometimes, you know, aloof, cool. She's so grounded in place. And I have to say that reading this book, I loved her even more. Like, I felt that. And even in the ways that she talked about race and racism, you know, especially in those early parts, you know, her own history, it's so detailed, her own striving, her feeling of being underestimated, her feeling of being the only Black person in her world as she's sort of moving through corporate worlds in Princeton and other places. Mm-hmm. And then she enters the maelstrom of national politics, and she talks about being bewildered by it all. Yeah. Suddenly for her to be cast as this Black radical, like, that's just not who she is. I want to tell you a quick story. The last week of the Obama administration, I think it was like the last week before the election, I actually went to the White House with my wife.
You went to the White House? What? You didn't take me?
To this there was a BET event, Black Entertainment Television, has a sort of, like, you know, celebration of the Obamas.
This must be a BET event. Hello, everybody. Hello. Welcome to the White House. I love you back. All right. That's why we're having this concert.
And I'm there because my wife has the hookup.
You told me about this. Yeah, saw everybody.
Yeah,
right?
So
Ta-Nehisi was there.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates writes about this, and he is there. Barack Obama gets on the stage with Belle Biv DeVoe and dances.
Cisco was there. Wasn't Cisco there too?
This woman, Yolanda Adams, this gospel singer, sings the John Legend part of Glory with Common, and it is just like, her sound, her voice is just ricocheting off the room. It's like the greatest musical experience I've ever had in my life. You know, it's like a religious experience. Dave Chappelle actually makes a joke there. He says that all the famous Black people and one white person, Bradley Cooper, but not the only one. Not the only one.
Not the only one.
Because this motherfucker was there too.
But I think it's important to note that you weren't there as journalist Ben Austin. You were there as arm candy to your beautiful Black wife.
So it was amazing. It was extraordinary. But the vibe of the night was just this, you know, celebration of the last 8 years, almost like pinching yourself and saying there really was like a Black first family in the White House. Mm-hmm. Like the whole evening is just this wild celebration. The election is in days. There wasn't one mention the entire night of the election. Get out the vote. Hillary Clinton is the best way to continue this legacy. We need to support her. Support your local elections. Not a word. Nothing. Yeah. Zero. Yeah. And so, you know, most people didn't expect that Trump was going to win. But it did happen. And you can't go back and talk about that night and talk about what a great celebration of looking backwards at these last 8 years without thinking about what was to come. And so there was that night, just this great omission. And, you know, that is a way also I think about Michelle's book, because you can't reckon with the past without thinking about what's going to come next. And I guess I would say, like, that's like, for her to do that, it would be a different book. It would be less uplifting. And maybe she would also be like a different person. But that's the difficult storytelling you also have to do.
And I guess to kind of bring it full circle, I think the frustration overall is understanding for the first time that Obama's gonna stick to his guns, right? And I mean that like in every way. He truly believes in American exceptionalism. His commitment to this notion of a promised land, I don't believe it in the way that he does, and that's okay. He wrote a book that basically said, no matter what's happened in our past, and no matter what happened during my presidency, and no matter what's happened since, including with the election of Donald Trump, that he's going to double down on it.
And I think actually both books, and when you talked about this belief in the country, both books sort of reference that King quote that Obama would often cite, that, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Bends towards justice, yeah.
That it is, it has this very optimistic view of the country. And the sense that the work it actually takes to move it towards justice. It's not that it bends on its own.
That is so well said, because that's my other point, like I wanted to say. Because I don't want to just seem like I'm like hating on our country, right? I live here too. Right? My people go back generations that I can't even number. My point is that the only way we ever got to make the country better was by facing the facts in front of us. And the facts of race and racism are the actual stories that Obama tells about American exceptionalism, the story of civil rights leaders, the stories of people who put on their marching shoes. He tells those stories constantly as if race and racism are only ever a thing of the past.
Mm.
And this book does the exact same thing. It keeps referring to the heroism and the sacrifice of people in the past, but never calls to arms the requirement and necessity of facing those facts before us.
The same thing in Becoming. I mean, so those powerful stories about her father and her grandfather of not having equal opportunity, mm-hmm. that the country does not allow the dream to happen for these black men, that isn't a thing of the past.
That's right.
That is something that could be applied to
not could
everything.
Be. Yeah. No.
She doesn't bring it up, you know, that past and sort of apply it to her own experiences in the White House.
Yeah.
It feels sort of you know, a little bit in amber in the background.
Yeah, well, I mean, this raises a whole series of questions that we've tried to explore just in centering how they talk and write about race and racism.
All right, Khalil, this was a great talk.
Yeah,
this
man.
Great chat.
Oh, man, this has been such an amazing experience. I learned from both my reading and listening to you and this conversation, for sure.
And Jen Salai.
And of course, Jen. Too. Yeah. 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 We got to do this again. This was fun. This was fun and productive.
All right. Love you.
Love you too. Some of My Best Friends Are is a production of Pushkin Industries. The show is written and hosted by me, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, and my best friend, Ben Austin.
It's produced by Cher Vincent and edited by Karen Shakurji. Our engineer is Martine Gonzalez. Our associate editor is Keyshelle Williams. And our showrunner is Sasha Mathias.
Our executive producers are Lee Tall Molad and Mia Lobel. At Pushkin, thanks to Heather Fain, Carly Migliori, John Schnars, and Jacob Weisberg.
Our theme song, Little Lily, is by fellow Chicagoan Avery R. Young from his amazing album, Tubman. You will definitely want to check out more of his music at his website, averyryoung.com.
You can find Pushkin on all social platforms at Pushkin Pods, and you can sign up for our newsletter at pushkin.fm. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you like to listen.
If you love this show and others from Pushkin Industries, consider becoming a Pushnik.
Pushnik is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted listening for $4.99 a month.
Look for Pushnik exclusively on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And most of all, I want to thank you, Khalil.
I want to thank you too, Mo.
All right. So Khalil, let's just move. We're flowing.
We are.
So you set me up.
Yeah, just like I was at a 50 cent party last night. He smelled like weed. I saw Big Daddy Kane at a concert in Manhattan. It was amazing.
No one's gonna accuse you of being a certain. Your bona fides are right there.